Today we're going to cover a sort of an introduction to the book of Daniel and then the first chapter. Daniel has 12 chapters, so it'll take us around 3 months to complete. We'll be at Christmas. And it's split in two. The first six chapters are the ones that you're familiar with. They contain the stories you heard in Sunday school about the fiery furnace and Daniel in the lion's den and the handwriting on the wall and all of that. The second half of Daniel is apocalyptic literature, and it's the largest segment of apocalyptic literature in the Old Testament, and second only to the revelation of St. John the Divine in the entire Bible. There's some debate on what the first half is. Some people would say that it's wisdom literature along the lines of, say, Ecclesiastes or Job. Another would say that it is prophetic in nature, because prophets are people who are able to clearly assess what's happening in a culture and what's wrong with it and how God feels about it, which is usually angry. What people are meant to do to respond to the situation, to repent and receive forgiveness and reconciliation, and what will happen if they don't. Because sin, whether it be idolatry or injustice, it has consequences. And having just worked our way through Samuel and Kings, we are aware that the consequences can be as severe as exile from the promised land. And this is actually the setting within which Daniel was written. These are stories of sort of aristocrats, as you recall from the past couple of weeks in our study of 2 Kings. They took soldiers, they took people from the royal court, folks who would be most useful, and they left the peasantry behind to work the land for the benefit of the mighty Babylonian Empire. And so this could be a blend of prophetic work, of wisdom literature. At one level, it doesn't really matter. But at another, having some idea of the general, the category that you're looking at can aid with interpretation. I think that it does contain both, though the prophetic strain is much more powerful, because these are situations that in contradiction to what we saw so much of in Samuel and Kings, is a situation where people do what God wants, even when there are consequences for that, even when they probably could have gone ahead and done what was asked of them without violating the law or compromising themselves and their beliefs. The difference between prophecy and apocalyptic literature, I think, needs to be made clear at the very outset. And, of course, we will review the nature of apocalyptic literature several weeks from now when we get to the second half of Daniel. Apocalyptic literature is kind of like prophecy on steroids. In prophecy, God works through the events of human history to create the outcomes that God desires. You'll see that throughout the latter prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. The first portions of those books are pretty much doom and gloom. You've done wrong, God's angry, and you're going to get it. But they also have hope in them that God will eventually relent, forgive His people, restore them. Apocalyptic doesn't work within the time frame of history. Apocalyptic literature, which is sort of, you can tell there's a lot of symbolism, a lot of metaphor, very difficult to interpret, perhaps impossible to interpret in some situations, because some of the meaning of the symbolism is lost to us, and I think even the meaning of some of it for the contemporaries who were receiving these apocalyptic works were esoteric and inaccessible. So God's going to intervene by ending history. There will be an episode, if you will, in the revelation to John. The events unfold over a period of 1,000 years. But the idea is that at a decisive moment, God will come. There will be a giant battle. And the guilty and wicked will be punished, and the righteous will be rewarded. So that's basically the difference. Prophecy believes God operates within the context of history. Apocalyptic thinks God operates by ending history. And you might even look at it as people who began thinking and writing apocalyptically had lost hope in the prophetic message, because so much time had gone by and Israel still had not been rescued, fully liberated. Because after they got back from Babylon, they went through a whole series of oppressors. They were under sort of Persian control, a vassal of Persia for a long while. Then Alexander the Great came through, and after him, he divided his kingdom up into three, and it was the northern kingdom that was really squeezing them hard. And then the Romans came through, and what you see in what we call the intertestamental period between, say, 400 BCE and through 100 AD is a proliferation of this apocalyptic material. And if you want to read it, you can probably go online, or at the very least at the library. It's probably not going to be your community library. You need to go to the main Louisville library or to one of the seminary libraries or one of the university libraries. The pseudepigrapha, which means false writings. And these are the books that didn't even come close to being included in the canon of Scripture, because they're kind of weird. And there's some wisdom literature in there, some lovely stories about Joseph and Aseneth, and in addition to power, Joseph found love the hard way. But you do have books like Enoch, which are really fun to read, and I'm really glad they're not in the Bible, because I wouldn't want to have to preach on them. That would be... Welcome to the rabbit hole. And it's because during this period there's just a waning hope, honestly, that the way that it's worked out in the past is the way that it will work out in the future. So God must have other plans, and this is how apocalyptic really develops. Daniel was written, we think, in a couple of tranches. Part of it was written between about 450 and 330 BCE, and this is in your notes, while another part was written sometime in 300 to 170 BC. And the reason we believe that is that this is such a blend. It's hard to say which was written when. When we get into chapter 2, though, we're going to see that just like we had some chronological narrative hitches in Samuel and Kings, you see some of the same in Daniel, which shows that, you know, this was sort of sewn together. This would make Daniel the newest book of the Bible, at least the newest book that made it in. And it's written in two languages, the only one in the Old Testament that is, Hebrew and Aramaic. And Hebrew was sacred language, and it would have been spoken and written, but Aramaic was kind of street language. And Aramaic was similar to Hebrew, and the section written in Aramaic begins with chapter 2, verse 4b, and runs through chapter 7, verse 28. And there are a lot of different theories about this dual linguistic and the idea that maybe it was all written in Aramaic and then portions of it were translated into Hebrew, which would have been considered a more appropriate language for a claimant to Scripture. And what's going on particularly during the latter time frame, 300 to 170 BC, is a series of revolts, particularly the Maccabean Revolt, which we talked about a little bit at the end of last week's section, in the mid-2nd century BCE. And you can certainly see within Daniel this desire for purity, this subtle critique of corrupt priests, this resistance against idolatrous foreign powers. You could certainly see the historical events of the 2nd century being influencing this work and being revealed through this work. We have no idea who wrote it. Daniel is probably a composite figure of those who did remain faithful to the Torah in extremis, and probably to sort of a punctilious level that wasn't really required. And the events, again, that we see here are set up during the exile in Babylon, which lasted roughly from 587 to 517 BCE. The book begins with an illustration of how God rewards the faithful who resist the temptation to conform. And I'm just going to read the chapter and we'll go from there. So, Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. These he brought to the land of Shinar and placed the vessels in the treasury of his gods. Then the king commanded his palace master Ashpenaz to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve in the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years, so that at the end of that time they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine, so he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your age, you would endanger my head with the king." Then Daniel asked the guard whom the palace master had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. You can then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men who eat the royal rations, and deal with your servants according to what you observe." So he agreed to this proposal and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was observed that they appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations. So the guard continued to withdraw their royal rations and the wine they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. To these four young men God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams. At the end of the time that the king had set for them to be brought in, the palace master brought them into the presence of Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them. And among them all, no one was found to compare with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they were stationed in the king's court. In every matter of wisdom and understanding concerning which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel continued there until the first year of King Cyrus. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay. So connecting with the end of 2 Kings, Nebuchadnezzar seizes Jerusalem, conquers it, takes all of the vessels of the temple and the palace, and brings them back to his own treasury. It was standard practice. To the victor goes the spoils, and in particular religious artifacts, because religion is such a core part of people's identities that if you can hold claim over that, and we'll see more about this in coming chapters, then you're really making a statement, your God is dead, and I killed your God. That would have been sort of the pagan perception on how all this worked. He sort of brought the elite, the best of the best, in to serve in his palace. They needed to be literate. They needed to be wise, but they needed to be trained for 3 years. The Chaldeans where essentially the priesthood of Nebuchadnezzar, described as magicians and enchanters, late in chapter 1. The king gives them royal rations. So they've got the best food and drink of anybody. But Daniel and his friends are reluctant. And we're not really sure why. Some would say that they couldn't be sure that the meat that they would be given to eat was slaughtered in the appropriate kosher manner, or that it could have been that the meat that they were given to eat were kind of the leftovers from animal sacrifices that were being made to false gods. It's also possible that they wanted to live not as the royal household did, but in a more ascetic fashion, as a way of separating themselves from it and sort of lessening the sense of reliance that they had on Nebuchadnezzar. Through God's intervention, the palace master agreed to give them a trial run of 10 days. He was nervous, understandably so, that, you know, if he let these four guys eat what they'd asked for, which is vegetables and water, that they'd get sort of puny in comparison with all the rest that were ostensibly eating the palace rations, and that he would get into trouble over that. So, you know, 10-day trial, and as it happens, after 10 days, they're looking better and fatter than everybody else, which just goes to show that dieting on vegetables will not help you get thinner. Or at least that's the excuse I'm using. If you want to borrow it, it's all on you. So they kept it going, and after 3 years, they were presented to the king, and he found no one as wise or as articulate as Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so they were stationed within the king's court, and he consulted with them, and they were able to provide better advice than everybody else assigned to this particular role. And Daniel stayed there for an extended period of time because it was Cyrus who defeated the Babylonians and decided to let people go back to Judah if they wanted to. Not all of them did, but some did. So Daniel must have been a young man indeed when he started service in the royal court of Babylon, and would have been, for that time period, quite old to function. Now, an issue that I actually forgot to mention was they were renamed. And we've talked about the importance of names and their meanings, and the power of names, particularly in certain magical formula when it came to the summoning or exorcism of demons. And so Daniel gets called Belteshazzar, which means protect the king's life. And so his identity is transformed because he's been conquered by this guy. He probably has zero interest in protecting him. And so the palace master was saying, your whole life and identity is different now. Abednego means servant of Nebu. Meshach is kind of a corruption of the word Mithra, at which it was a major god for the Babylonians at that time. And I can't remember what I got up. Okay, I got a bending. Okay, cool. Anyway, so this is how the story begins. Major change, but also a major opportunity to offer a witness, which begins by asking for control over their own diet, which God facilitates, they're vindicated by their decision and end up being elevated to the highest rank. So what are you seeing that I'm not, or what questions might you have? It's a short chapter.
I've read about three different versions of this, and one of the footnotes said that fat actually meant healthy.
I'm sure it meant healthy. Yeah, appeared better and healthier. Although, you know, back in those days, fat was healthy. You know, it was a way also to demonstrate your wealth. You know, if you could eat fatty foods, that wasn't something that everybody had access to. And particularly eating to excess, that's not something many people could do.
Michael, Daniel guessing from this, other than he's a child beginning, he wasn't anything special or anyone special before that.
No, there's no indication. In fact, we have no clue who this Daniel is. Again, it's believed that he sort of is a personification of the people who remain faithful to God in exile. There are Daniels mentioned in latter prophets, but there's no explicit connection made that would necessarily, because I mean, Daniel is a relatively common name, you know. So. I mean, I came prepared for chapter 2, if you want to move on, because I know that chapter 1 is more of an intro, and it's just on a little bit on the thin side. Yeah, no hurries. We don't have to rush out. Go ahead, Caroline.
Well, Nebuchadnezzar was Babylonian, is that right?
Yeah.
And Cyrus was not?
Persian.
Persian?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to start sliding these on around.
What was your reference to the Apocrypha?
First and Second Maccabees in the Apocrypha. And what that is a chronicle of a mid-second century BCE revolution led by brothers who were known as the Maccabees, which in Hebrew means hammer. They fought against the Assyrians. They were outraged by the abomination of desecration, which was the establishment of a statue of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who was the Assyrian emperor who controlled Palestine at that time. And he had erected, he was very intolerant. Most people back then being pantheists, having a pantheon of gods, a multiplicity of gods, they were pretty tolerant of other people. He not so much so when it came to the worship of himself. And so there was an armed conflict. It was successful for a period of several years. But the problem was the Maccabees seized the monarchy and the high priesthood, and they were not from the house of David or Levi. So their assumption of these offices was illegitimate. And what you get near the end of Maccabees is an indication that God's punishment and the end of Israel's liberty came from this fact. They got greedy. They got bubble-headed and greedy. So, but it's an interesting read. It's kind of long and repetitive, but if you've made it through Samuel and Kings, you can make it through 1st and 2nd Maccabees.
So why is the reference to Cyrus at the end of this first chapter? I mean, is it just to indicate how long Daniel
hung
around?
Exactly. And, you know, we'll get into chapter 2 when we get to chapter 2. You ready? Yeah, oh, sorry, God, Jen.
It's included in the text.
And ours. Yeah. Yeah. You really have to look when you go get Bibles. Some study Bibles have it and some don't. The New Oxford Annotated Version has it, and I'm not sure. New English Bible has it. But again, you can find the Apocrypha online easily as a PDF, and you can read it on your screen or print it out if you want to. Okay, let's jump into chapter 2.
No, has it between Old and New Testament?
In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed such dreams that his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. So the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had such a dream that my spirit is troubled by the desire to understand it." The Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will reveal the interpretation." The king answered the Chaldeans, "This is a public decree. If you do not tell me both the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you do tell me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." They answered a second time, "Let the king first tell his servants the dream, then we can give its interpretation." The king answered, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see I have firmly decreed, if you do not tell me the dream, there is but one verdict for you. You have agreed to speak lying and misleading words to me until things take a turn. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can reveal what the king demands. In fact, no king, however great and powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king is asking is too difficult, and no one can reveal it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with mortals." Because of this, the king flew into a violent rage and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. The decree was issued, and the wise men were about to be executed, and they looked for Daniel and his companions to execute them. Then Daniel responded with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the king's chief executioner, who had gone out to execute the wise men of Babylon. He asked Arioch, the royal official, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. Then Daniel went in and requested that the king give him time, and he would tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his home and informed his companions, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might, with the rest of the wise men of Babylon, not perish. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night, and Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, "Blessed be the name of God from age to age, for wisdom and power are His. He changes times and seasons, deposes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with Him. To you, O God of my ancestors, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power, and have now revealed to me what we asked of you, for you have revealed to us what the king ordered." Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will give the king the interpretation." Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, "I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who can tell the king the interpretation." The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered the king, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or diviners can show to the king the mystery that the king is asking. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has disclosed to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen at the end of days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed were these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be hereafter, and the revealer of mysteries disclosed to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me because of any wisdom that I have more than any other living being, but in order that the interpretation may be known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. You were looking, O king, and lo, there was a great statue. This statue was huge, its brilliance extraordinary. It was standing before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of that statue was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked on, a stone was cut out, not by human hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory, into whose hand he has given human beings wherever they live, the wild animals of the field and the birds of the air, and whom he has established as ruler over them all, you are the head of gold. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the whole earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, just as iron crushes and smashes everything, it shall crush and shatter all these. As you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the strength of iron shall be in it, as you saw the iron mixed with the clay. As the toes of the feet were part iron and part clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall this kingdom be left to another people. It shall crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw that a stone was cut from the mountain, not by hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has informed the king what shall be hereafter. The dream is certain, and its interpretation trustworthy. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, worshipped Daniel, and commanded that a grain offering and incense be offered to him. The king said to Daniel, "Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay, so Daniel's already been presented to the king, but it appears that in chapter 2 you have sort of a change in the chronological sequence of the narrative, where the king appears to have met Daniel for the first time. It may be that the king met Daniel, but you know, the king met lots of people, and Daniel wasn't that important, so we forgot. But who knows? Who does this remind you of in chapter 2?
Pharaoh.
Huh?
Pharaoh.
And Joseph. Yes. This is definitely a throwback to Pharaoh and Joseph, because of the capacity not only to interpret dreams, but to know the king's dreams themselves. And this is where we shift into Aramaic, where the king has a nightmare. He doesn't understand it. He calls all of his magicians and enchanters and sorcerers and the Chaldeans, and they say, "Tell me what the dream was," because it was only by that sort of astonishing insight that he would trust their interpretation. Otherwise, he was afraid that they would basically tell him what he wanted to hear. And sort of prove their veracity, they had to be given the power of wisdom to know the dream itself. And they sort of went back and forth with him. And he says, "Well, tell us the dream. Tell us the dream and we'll interpret it for you." And he says, "I know what you're up to. It's not going to work. If you don't tell me the dream, I'm going to slaughter all of you guys, every last one." And they moan and complain and say, you know, "That's really not fair. And that's not the way you speak to a king." So they only stoked his rage. And of course, Daniel and his companions would have been included within this group of people to be executed, to have their heads chopped off. And Daniel goes to the royal official Arioch, and he says, well, you know, what's the hurry? Give me a little bit of time, and maybe I can help you out here and save a lot of lives and satisfy the king at the same time. So he goes and he tells Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and it's no mistake that in their private conversations they retain their true names, and they're only called these new names by the Babylonians, and they decide to pray, as Joseph did, that they might receive what the dream was and also how they were meant to interpret it. Daniel gets the dream and the interpretation. He sings a song of thanksgiving to God, one in which all things are under his control, including deposes kings and sets up kings. Wisdom is given to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. And he goes to Arioch and he says, I got it. Bring me to the king. So Daniel tells the king the dream and the interpretation. And basically, it's an enormous, intimidating statue made of different materials. It starts with gold at the top, moves down to silver, then bronze, then iron mixed with clay. And so from top to bottom, you have a descent of inferior materials. And, of course, it's really nice that Nebuchadnezzar is symbolized by the golden head. I'm sure that you know, he felt really good about that. We're not 100% sure which of the succeeding kingdoms Daniel's referring to. If we go strictly by chronological order, what you have is the Median, then the Persian, then the Hellenistic, and the Tetrarchy, which was Alexander the Great died, and he divided what he had conquered up into three pieces. So that would have been the feat of mixed clay and iron, and that's, don't think reinforced concrete. This was a bad idea. Those materials did not mix or bind together. So what you're looking at is something almost designed to shatter. And what Daniel is saying is that you're going to be fine. But over time, as different kingdoms assume control over this part of the earth, they're going to get weaker and weaker and weaker. And of course, the clay mixed with iron would have been contemporaneous with the situation of the mid-second century and the Maccabean revolt. And that's one among many reasons why they think that at least some of Daniel was written or at least reordered during that time period. So they thought that they were about to see the iron and the clay shattered, and that this stone that would shatter them would be a stone from Mount Zion thrown by God, which would grow up into a mountain, kind of like those little sponge animals you get. You know, you stick them in the water and they swell up, and 5 minutes later your kids don't care anymore and you wonder why you spent $3 on that. Not or beyond that, of course, but, you know, the memories linger. So the hope there was that, you know, God would finally release them from foreign control, which ended up not happening. So, at least not for very long. And then as the chapter concludes, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges Yahweh as the God of God and Lord of Kings. This conversion is not going to stick for very long. And in fact, he misunderstands the nature of Yahweh so much that he actually starts worshiping Daniel. He lavishes gifts on him. He draws him into the inner circle of the court because he could do what so many could not. This is a contrast between Daniel, who acts very calm and cool. You know, I can only imagine the enchanters and the magicians and the Chaldeans trying to book their flights to anywhere but there. And but Daniel comes with, "What's all the fuss? Oh, I see. We're all going to have our heads chopped off. Well, if you can give me a little bit of time, I can probably help you with that." And then he goes into the king and he says, "Well, you know, here's the deal." And he's able to shape the information in such a way that this tyrant, who's totally lost his cool and within a few chapters is going to be afflicted by God into madness. So Nebuchadnezzar is a bit on the unstable side. It's just a significant contrast, because for those who worship Yahweh, even in the most trying of times, they can have peace and wisdom and live their lives with an equanimity that someone like Nebuchadnezzar simply cannot, despite all the advantages of his absolute rule and power and all the comforts that are his. So that's chapter 2 in a nutshell. Oh, and at the end of it, the true wisdom of Daniel is exhibited by the fact that he's appointed governor of a region, the central region of the empire. And Daniel says, you know, if it's okay with you, I would just as soon as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do this. You know, great power of dodging and delegation, where he's not caught up in the administration of the court, but he's still part of the court, because he has a different role to fulfill, because this capacity to seek God's help in discerning mysteries will be of great assistance to the king, and also continue to show forth the glory of the one true God.
That statement in verse 44, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom, never be destroyed, and this kingdom will not be left to another. That almost refers to Christ's statement.
It could. Certainly, Jesus had spent some time with the book of Daniel. His description of himself as Son of Man comes from the second half of Daniel, chapter 7 to be specific, the apocalyptic portion. When you see the Son of Man coming with clouds of great glory, that's where he gets that from. This is the apocalyptic edge of Jesus being channeled through the language and concepts of Daniel. So, looking backwards through the lens of the resurrection, we reinterpret a lot of Hebrew scripture and begin to realize that, the authors were saying and writing more than they realized. And it's an experience that I think all of us have had, where inspiration has struck and there was embedded with something we said or written more meaning than we initially realized. Sometimes I go back and find old sermons or whatever, and I reread them, and I'm just like, huh, I didn't get that when I read it and said it. And sometimes it's just like, oh, good Lord, how did I write this at the age of 23? This is actually pretty good, you know. And, you know, so... That happens a lot, and oftentimes that sort of concealed wisdom, if you will, it's usually within the mouths of people who are opposing the agents of God's purposes. You could also look at verse 44 of chapter 2 as sort of a foreshadowing of the more apocalyptic vision that is to come. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall this kingdom be left to another people. It shall crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Because the people who are assembling this material are hopeful that that will be the case, but at the moment, they have no reason to believe that within the context of history, it shall be. And so you could see a bit of an apocalyptic edge working its way in as early as chapter 2 with verse 44. Apocalyptic, by the way, or apocalypse, is a fascinating word. It's a Greek word that means to reveal the concealed. And so the purpose of apocalyptic literature is to open up the mysteries of God's purpose and how they'll be accomplished. But it's an ironic word, because so often apocalyptic literature obfuscates as much as it clarifies, because of the heavy symbolism involved in an attempt to reveal divine things that don't fit neatly into human language. So I'm still listening. I'm just going to grab a little more coffee here.
That's why you have to kind of use your imagination and envision what the words mean, what they're describing in apocalyptic literature.
Well, and that opens them up to polyvalent interpretation, because symbols themselves are capable of bearing a multiplicity of meanings. I mean, some people, let's take the American flag as an example. You know, at one level, the symbol can be explicated very easily. The 13 stripes represent the 13 colonies. Red symbolizes the sacrifice of blood that was given for independence. The white symbolizes purity of the purpose. You have the blue background, water and sky, and then the 50 stars, each one for each state, those stars being white. But it goes so far beyond that, almost to the point of fetish for some people, where it goes beyond symbol to an embodiment of the nation itself, and therefore it is sacred. But to many other people around the world, the stars and stripes is an object of hatred, because it is seen as a tool of imperial oppression. So that symbol can be interpreted in so many different ways. And this is true of the symbols you find in apocalyptic literature. Some of it we can tie down, you know, like the sacred numbers that appear repeatedly, 7, 12, 3, 40. But when you get to stuff like the sign of the beast is 666, there's really no way to know. Because you can't... The use of numbers to represent words is called gematria, and it's a one-way street. You can take a name, and then you take a numerical quantity assigned to different letters of, say, the Hebrew alphabet. And then by adding up the value of every letter, you get a number. The problem is when you try to reverse that process and come up with a name that equals 666, it comes out to lots of different things. There are a lot of different combinations and possibilities. And of course, then you get into the point of, well, how accurate are the valuations of the letters of the alphabet? And does it work for other languages? And, you know, are these arbitrary assignations, or are they inspired by the Lord? And, you know, I mean, I think the number 666 is unfigure outable. The only thing that I can see in it, I love making up words, is that 7 is a perfect number. And 37, since 3 is a sacred number as well, that's a really holy number. A 6 is a deficient number. Because it's one short of 7 and it's half of 12. And it's only twice 3, not thrice 3. And so this 666 is the symbol of the beast, is ultimately a symbol of insufficiency. And if anything, designed to demonstrate the ultimate victory of God over this lesser being. I've taught Revelations, and to be honest, it was one of the most boring books I've ever taught, because you're digging through all this really weird stuff, and some of it you can figure out and some of it you can't, you know, because you're reading commentaries from people who have studied this stuff all their lives, and dream in Greek and Hebrew, and you know, you're reading through these convoluted explanations, and I'm just thinking, you know, you could have just said, right here, I'm shrugging my shoulders, let's move on. And because the principal message of Revelation is, and it comes just in the opening chapters, I know that life is rough right now being a Christian, but you better hang on, because God's going to fix it all soon, and you don't want to find yourself on the wrong side. Because if you're on the wrong side, you're going to suffer eternally. And if you're on the right side, you're going to suffer for a fairly lengthy period of time. But at the end, everything's going to be okay. That's it. That's Revelation right there. That's it. Yeah. The rest is just this horrific explication of this is how you know when it's happening. And of course, some of that is similar to what you'd find in chapter 13 of Mark, which is known as Mark's little apocalypse, where Jesus gives people the signs of the times. And you have things like famine, war, pestilence, things that happen in every generation. You're going to have earthquakes, and you're going to have celestial signs, and these are things that are recurrent generation after generation. And so the signs of the times really don't give you a whole lot to go on. But in John's revelation, it's the degree of severity, which is detailed at great length. That's how you know. You know, it's when all hell breaks loose. You know, but like the red tide down in Florida, I'm sure you've read about this, which is a bacteria that thrives in certain oceanic conditions. I'm sure there are Christians somewhere that are saying, oh, it's that tide of blood that it talks about, and this is the beginning of the end. But you get red tides all over the world, all of the time, and it's not blood. It's these unhealthy bacteria that do harm you if you get in contact with them. But I just don't think we know, you know. I'm not sure that answered any question because I forgot what it was. Yeah, Caroline.
On the topic, what about these Chaldeans? What are they? Are they from a particular place?
It's a title. It's basically the royal priesthood of the Babylonians, and the Chaldeans were an ethnic group within that area.
So that's why it's capitalized that they were an ethnic
group. Yeah.
Whole.
Yeah, in a way, if memory serves and is, you know, the proper priests of Israel were Levites, capital L, because they came from the tribe of Levi. And so the Chaldeans were a specific ethnic group within the Babylonian Empire who had sort of a priestly pedigree, is what I'm remembering.
This footnote says the Chaldeans were probably astrologers. Mm-hmm. Who were so associated with the Chaldeans in the Hebrew mind that in the later language they are sometimes simply called by the name of that people.
There we go. Bingo.
Here's Google.
Memory did serve.
Mm-hmm. Did you
hear Google? Yeah, I always want to hear what Google has to say.
Chaldea or was a Semitic speaking nation that existed between the late 10th or early 9th and mid 6th centuries B.C., after which it and its people were absorbed and assimilated into Babylonia. It was located in the marshy land of the far southeastern corner of Mesopotamia and briefly came to rule Babylon.
Cool. We got it.
There's pictures.
I find it fascinating that the astrologers say what the king asks is too difficult, no one can reveal to the king except the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Daniel comes up, he says no wise man can explain that there is a God in heaven who is revealed.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't hear them say that, but he knows that that's the cause of him being able to mm-hmm. respond to that.
Well, and Daniel, he's a savior in the passage. I mean, all of these guys are going to be killed. And they've already told the king, and you're right, he wasn't present for that audience. Maybe he heard about it, but, you know, if he would have said, yeah, I'm smarter than all the rest, Nebuchadnezzar might have gone ahead and killed them. Well, what do I need these donkeys for? Because, you know, I got Daniel, he's all I need. But he said, in effect, yeah, only God knows this, but God has given this to me. Yeah, because ostensibly these sorcerers, or and whatever you want to call them, would have, as Daniel did, consulted the gods. But they either didn't because they didn't expect the gods could give them the answers, or they did and the gods wouldn't or couldn't because they were false. And so only Daniel's God comes out good at the end of this.
And he was an evangelist. I mean, he gave him, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he...
Even though...
It's a mixed record with Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, but, even though Nebuchadnezzar didn't... His conversion didn't last, I mean, that's nothing unusual anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't always stick. It doesn't always stick. Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon, you know, for people who have no mechanism of accountability to sort of get crazy on you when they're not getting what they want. But Nebuchadnezzar is going to set up a statute that he wants people to worship. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not going to do that. He's going to try to burn them to death. That doesn't work out. You have another conversion experience. Then you have a sort of another conflict, and you know, and they're having a celebration, and king gets wasted, and this disembodied hand starts writing on the raw wall, and nobody knows what it means except for Daniel, and he explains it to him, and it basically said, God has found you wanting, and the punishment for that is he went out and thought he was a cow for a while. I don't remember. He didn't reign for the entire time. He was succeeded by his son. What was that fellow's name? King Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus, not of Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm not sure.
King Cyrus conquered Babylon in 539.
Yeah. I have not consulted the commentaries up to chapters 4 and 5. At least I haven't for 9 years since I last taught this. So I'm sure, though, that we have adequate non-biblical sources to identify the transition. Because at this point in history, they were keeping durable records of significant events.
It says he was the longest and most any monarch in the
Neo-Babylonian
Empire from 605
BC to 562. Okay. So he was in charge for the first 15 years of the exile. It's a pretty good run.
Without getting assassinated?
Yeah. Well, so looking ahead, we'll definitely do chapter 3, and we might get ourselves into chapter 4. Chapter 4 is a pretty long chapter, but it's not laden with content, nor is it terribly complex. So be prepared for 4 in case we get that far, and if we don't, that's okay too. All righty. Everybody get notes? Okay, we got any extras?